Greetings from the Audible Local Ledger, located in beautiful Mashpee, Massachusetts, serving the Cape, Islands, and South Coast as part of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network, your main source for news. The Ledger delivers print information and entertainment to the blind, those with low vision, and the print impaired. Read by our Cape Cod volunteers, select reading services from around the country, and our broadcast partner, the Talking Information Center. You may sometimes hear their content in the morning, but it's the Cape's very own Audible Local Ledger and its volunteers that broadcast local news and information 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. This is George Krein, and I'll be reading you selections from Barron's Magazine for the week of January 11th, 2021. We'll begin with today's cover story. Here comes Joe Biden's Washington. Consider these stocks and funds for your portfolio. The recent turmoil in Washington, D.C. could easily have upended stocks and may well have done so in another era. It isn't every day that a mob incited by the president storms Capitol Hill. This is a market determined to march higher, and it's not about to be derailed even by historic mayhem in the nation's capital. Stocks are rallying on the trillions of dollars in stimulus that may only be accelerated under the new administration. A chaotic political season is winding down while the economy is gearing for a post-pandemic reopening. Investors need to keep their eyes forward and look ahead to a Joe Biden presidency, to more predictable domestic policies, smoother trade relations, and additional efforts to revive the economy. Now might not be a good time to own anything defensive. Barron's asked portfolio managers and investment strategists which stocks and exchange-traded funds to consider for the coming months. That's not to say a Washington controlled by the Democrats, as this past week's Senate runoff elections in Georgia determined, will be entirely friendly to investors. The Democratic agenda includes corporate and individual tax increases, heightened regulatory oversight, and such ambitious social and economic policies as a Green New Deal, health care reform, and student loan forgiveness. All of that could drive up deficit spending and fuel inflationary pressures, putting the Federal Reserve in a bind as it tries to keep interest rates down. Wall Street, however, isn't trembling at the prospect of Democrats taking charge of both houses of Congress and the White House for the first time since 2009. Quite the contrary. The markets are anticipating another quick hit of fiscal stimulus, including checks for millions of Americans and aid for state and local governments. Bond yields are up on expectations of heightened inflation and faster growth early in Biden's term. History suggests that equities will do fine with Democrats in Washington. The S&P 500 index has returned an average of 14% a year when Democrats have controlled Congress and the White House since 1948, according to DataTrack research. The Dow Jones Industrial Average has gained an average of 15.7%, according to Bespoke Investment Group. The markets appear to be betting on politicians who talk of home runs but hit legislative bunts. Democrats have neither the political capital nor the votes in Congress for sweeping change. The party holds a slimmer majority in the House than it did before the November election. Just one Democratic defection in the Senate would be a legislative deal killer. That could leave centrists like Democrat Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Republican Susan Collins of Maine wielding more power. The threshold for another stimulus bill is low, but the bigger grand plans will take longer, says Chris Senyek, chief investment strategist at Wolf Research. The average tax reform bill takes 15 months after a new president is sworn in, plenty of time for markets to keep rallying and adjust. Stocks are in a bubble, Senyek says, but we're not going to fight it. Early winners have included small caps, clean tech, cyclicals, and value. A steeper yield curve would be delightful for banks, insurance companies, and other financials. Some sectors could face more pressure. Real estate and utilities are falling behind as bond yields jump. Energy, financials, and healthcare could see tougher regulation under Biden. Big tech is a toss-up. It's in the crosshairs of both political parties and faces antitrust actions in the U.S. and Europe. Multiples are steep, and the sector is vulnerable to higher interest rates as investors rotate from growth to value. Yet, investors are still expected to put a premium on secular growth. Based on historical trends, defensive sectors are likely to trail the S&P 500 by 12 percentage points if U.S. growth hits the consensus estimates of 4% this year, according to Jim Paulson, chief investment strategist at Luthold Group. If gross domestic product accelerates to 6%, which he expects, defensives could trail the market by 23%. Investors who thought they were responsible, avoiding the popular risky stocks, could be subject to unexpected pain in 2021 due to a year of growth not experienced in decades. All of this presumes that Washington continues to pile on stimulus and that the markets aren't spooked by countervailing forces. Higher corporate and individual taxes, steeper interest rates, or geopolitical crisis. Expectations for the pandemic to recede rapidly are baked into Wall Street profit estimates. Markets are also counting on an easing of trade frictions with China and more favorable trade policies overall, neither of which is assured. And the market may be underestimating the impact of the deregulatory drive that took place under Trump. The deregulatory impact of the past 4 years was greater than the tax cuts, says George Maris, co-head of equities at Janus Henderson. Economists estimate that deregulation fueled more than $100 billion in economic activity annually, he adds. Companies felt extraordinary relief from a less antagonistic relationship with Washington. Still, the negatives are a ways off if they materialize at all. Without killing the filibuster in the Senate, Democrats will have to use budget reconciliation to pass a tax overhaul or infrastructure plan with a simple majority. That probably means making deals with moderates. Regulatory overkill may also be less likely. Regulation was so severe under Obama that I think there's a feeling it went too far, says Michael Kagan, a portfolio manager with ClearBridge Investments. This is going to be a government led by moderates. Tax increases are probably a 2022 event, phased in gradually and coming only if the economy gains a stronger foundation. Even then, the deficit hawks will have less firepower if the Fed can hold long-term bond yield near historic lows. The Fed can now sell 30-year treasuries at 1.63% rate and pay 0.89% in interest on 10-year notes. Inflation will have to cooperate for rates to stay this low, and the Fed may need to reinvent the twist in buying and selling short-term and long-term securities. If it works, Washington would have a few more years of nearly free money to finance new spending, avoiding the need for steep tax increases. If it works, Washington would have a few more years of nearly free money to finance new spending, and one way to play this market is to ride the renormalization wave. Travel, leisure, and other consumer discretionary stocks. Among the stocks recommended by Wolf Research's Senyek are Walt Disney, ticker DIS, Booking Holdings, ticker BKNG, Darden Restaurants, DRI, and Southwest Airlines, LUV. The Invesco Dynamic Leisure and Entertainment ETF, PEJ, also captures the theme. Everybody's been cooped up, and if vaccine rollouts are successful, people will be booking 2 months of vacation this summer, says Jim Bishaw, chief investment officer at GenTrust, who holds the ETF for clients. Home builders have a strong setup. Mortgage rates are low. Demand is rising as people move to suburbs, and supplies of new houses have been constrained by construction delays and a lack of finished lots. Toll Brothers, TOL, is Kagan's top pick, trading at 1.3 times book value, a multiple he thinks could double through the cycle. He also likes home builders Lennar, L-E-N, and NVR. NVR. Ben Phillips, chief investment strategist at Savoy, that's S-A-V-O-I, I'll let you pronounce that, Capital, a family office advisor, sees a few policy themes as winners, like cybersecurity, clean energy, healthcare technology, and infrastructure. His cybersecurity picks include Okta, Okay, and its ticker is OKTA, same as its name. Zscaler, ZS, and CyberArk, that's CYBER, capital ARK, ARK, CyberArk Software, CYBR. Clean energy looks attractive. Long term, though the sector is crowded and ripe for a pullback, the iShares Global Clean Energy ETF, ICLN, is up 14% since the Georgia runoff elections and is ahead 60% in the past 6 months, pushing up multiples sharply. Bulls argue that the sector is making up for a lost decade. The ETF lost 30% from 2010 to 2020, including dividends. Phillips sees the green theme playing out for years, supported by more favorable government policies, asset flows into sustainable funds, and initiatives to decarbonize the global economy. His picks include a couple of limited partnerships, Brookfield Renewable Partners, BEP, and Hannon Armstrong Sustainable Infrastructure Capital, HASI. Brookfield owns more than $50 billion in assets like renewable energy power plants and has increased its distribution by 6% annually for two decades. The units yield 2.3%. Hannon invests in green projects, including wind, solar, and commercial energy efficiency, managing $6.6 billion in equity and debt investments. The partnership units yield 2%. Infrastructure-related stocks have already jumped on prospects for a spending plan finally making it through Congress. Last summer, House Democrats passed a $1.5 trillion package. Senate Republicans dismissed it as a green giveaway, but they have indicated support for increased highway and other infrastructure spending. It may just take a couple of centrists to push a bill through. Vulcan Materials, VMC, a supplier of construction aggregates, asphalt, and other materials, is already up 10% this year, but still looks attractive, says Kagan of Clearbridge, particularly because housing construction could also lift revenue above clean current estimates. Vulcan is a name we own and like a lot, he says. Maris also likes the backdrop of materials and industrials. Copper demand is outstripping supply, he says, and the industry has consolidated. Rio Tinto, RIO, and Teck Resources, and Teck is spelled TECK, and the ticker symbol is TECK, look attractive. Industrial equipment maker Parker Hannifin, PH, should see margins expand, and it sells a mix of short and long cycle products, supporting revenue growth throughout a cyclical upswing. Financials are starting to awaken. The Financial Select Sector Spider Fund, XLF, is up 23% in the past 3 months, more than doubling the S&P 500's gains. A steeper yield curve would work wonders for the sector, reviving profits on loans and underlying portfolio assets. Brokerage firm Charles Schwab, SCHW, makes a killing on interest income. The stock has gained 56% in the past 3 months and is emblematic of expectations for steeper yield curve and higher short-term rates. Kagan likes Bank of America, BAC, for its diversified operating profile that includes brokerage, advisory, consumer, and commercial banking. Another stock to consider is insurance giant Travelers, TRV. Insurers benefit from higher yields on their investment portfolios. Payouts on claims are running below average thanks to less mobility in the workforce and fewer accident claims. Pricing for commercial and property insurance, meanwhile, is looking strong. Of course, there's another way to play all these themes, Berkshire Hathaway. BRKB, Warren Buffett's conglomerate, offers exposure to insurance, housing, railroads, and energy, along with a portfolio of growth and value stocks handpicked by Buffett and his team. Berkshire stock is up just 3% in the past year and looks relatively cheap at 1.2 times book value. Buffett is also sitting on $145 billion in cash and short-term securities. Whatever happens in Washington, that's money that probably won't be wasted. It's our custom here to read the cover story from Barron's, that whatever week we're doing, and then jump immediately to the topics section of Barron's with particular focus on retirement. And that's what we're doing today, and there are a number of articles that are worth your attention. Beginning with, Target Date 2020 funds did well in 2020. Here's why, and it's written by Debbie Carlson. For anyone who's been contemplating retiring in 2020, the first quarter couldn't have been easy. Stocks fell 34% in 23 days as the pandemic took hold and the economy quickly weakened. These stomach-churning moments are when investors make some of their worst mistakes, the kinds of mistakes that automatic investment products like target date funds try to circumvent. In 2020, they largely did. As of December 31st, 2020, the average return of a vintage 2020 target date fund was 10.8%, 1 percentage point lower than the 11.7% return for a balanced fund with 50% to 70% equity allocation, according to data from Morningstar Direct. In the first quarter, 2020 target date funds overall fell 10% on average. That's only in the first quarter. For investors in these set-it-and-forget-it products, 2020's performance offers reason for comfort. Target date funds are meant to weather all market conditions. These funds own a mix of stocks and bonds and generally gradually shift toward a more conservative portfolio as the year that's in the fund's name approaches. The amount of stock held in funds nearing their target date has long been a concern. Many fund companies say their target date funds are meant to be owned through a decades-long retirement, which means they can be more aggressively invested. Critics say that many target date funds have too much in stock in the year people are meant to retire. Like so many other ideas, 2020 made people think differently. Generally, 2020 target date funds were conservative enough to cushion the market's blow early in the year, and they held enough in stocks, typically 40 to 60%, that they rebounded quickly. People who had circled the end of 2020 as their retirement date were lucky that the stock market's steep but brief sell-off happened early in the year, giving funds time to recoup losses, said Todd Rosenbluth, director of exchange-traded and mutual fund research at CFRA. A prolonged bear market, such as the one that took hold during the 2008-2009 global financial crisis, likely would have meant they had to delay their retirement plans, he adds. While stock holdings tend to drive overall performance, a manager's fixed income strategy influenced early year performance in 2020 and how much ground had to be made up in the second half, says Jason Kephart, strategist at Morningstar. Vanguard, the largest target date asset manager, sticks to high quality fixed income with a mix of government, investment grade corporate, and securitized debt. The $33 billion Vanguard Target Retirement Fund, ticker VTWNX, has 50% in fixed income. It returned 12% last year. Similarly, the $8.6 billion BlackRock LifePath Index Retirement, LIRKX, has a 60% fixed income weighting, and it returned 12.2% in 2020. We don't have to do as much on the upside if we don't lose as much on the downside, says Nick Nefous, N-E-F-O-U-S-E, head of BlackRock's LifePath Target Date Fund lineup. Brian Miller, senior investment product manager at Vanguard, says a high-quality bond portfolio also functions as a brake on impulsive behaviors, keeping investors in the market during times of crisis by mitigating equity risk. We try to design these to balance some of the many risks that investors face, one of them being market risk. The second and third largest target date providers, Fidelity Investments and T. Rowe Price, are more growth-oriented. The fixed income sleeves of the $26 billion Fidelity Freedom 2020, that's FFFDX, and the $16 billion T. Rowe Price Retirement 2020 Fund, TRRBX, include small allocations to high yield and emerging markets debt, along with high quality fixed income. In 2020, T. Rowe's fund returned 13.2%, and Fidelity's fund returned 13.8%. T. Rowe Price Retirement 2020 has 60% in stocks, which helped in the second half. Joe Martell, portfolio specialist and member of T. Rowe Price's Target Date Funds team, says that while the first quarter hit the funds hard, the 2020 fund fell 14.2%. Two specific actions helped performance last year: rebalancing during the sell-off and the decision to take a small tactical overweight to equities in March, thereby leaning into the sell-off. Valley Freedom has about half of its assets in stocks, 36% in bonds, and 12.5% in cash. Brett Summison, portfolio manager at Fidelity, says the fund also took advantage of the sell-off to buy more stock. The mechanism is actually one of the really powerful things that happens in a target date fund to drive returns, he says. Your 401k could soon offer a lifetime income option, and this is written by Lewis Brom. Target date funds are about to undergo a major facelift. These asset allocation funds in your 401k with end dates like 2030 or 2040 to match your expected retirement, and we just talked about this at some length, will soon add more unusual investments, annuities, and perhaps even private equity to their stock bond portfolio mix. The biggest fund companies have been working for years to come up with a retirement income product that rivals annuities, which are insurance products. Now, thanks to recent regulation, they don't need to. According to a survey of the largest target date fund managers published in December by financial research firm Cerulli Associates, some 92% of target date management firms expect that a deferred income annuity allocation will be part of target date investments in the future. Deferred income annuities are insurance contracts in which the buyer gives an insurer a lump sum in exchange for guaranteed lifetime income that begins at a later date. Retired and ready for post-COVID life? Yes, that was me speaking. Here are some considerations. It's written by Daisy Maxey. Many seniors and retirees saw their accounts swell last year amid reduced spending, stock market gains, and deferred required minimum distributions as the pandemic turned the world topsy-turvy. With vaccines set to help restore a semblance of pre-COVID life, now then is a good time to consider how to redeploy unused vacation funds, reallocate assets that may have gotten out of balance, and re-engage with a changed world. Even with pandemic precautions likely to remain in place for some time and an uncertain recovery, financial advisors and transition experts say there are a number of steps seniors can take to alleviate anxiety and mitigate risks. Redeploying lockdown savings. Most of our clients have money building up because they haven't been able to spend it on vacations, dining out, or entertainment, says Judy Rubin, a wealth manager at Plaza Advisory Group at Steward Partners in St. Louis. Most have seen their investment values climb past pre-COVID levels. As such, she says, many investors should reallocate some profits from riskier assets. Depending on a client's situation and risk appetite, she's investing in value or income-oriented stock funds, certificates of deposit, for the peace of mind despite the paltry rates, or short-term bond funds and other short-term assets, she says. If you were a moderate investor 5 years ago and you haven't rebalanced lately, chances are that now your portfolio has drifted to being much closer to moderately aggressive. You've got to trim from the investments that have had outsized growth and move that money to something safer if you're going to be able to keep your portfolio in that moderate position. Doug Kobach, founder of Mainline Group Wealth Management in Conshohocken, Pennsylvania, is shifting some clients' profits from technology-focused investments into holdings with a lower correlation to the broader stock market, such as long-short mutual funds, which seek to maximize the upside of markets while limiting the downside risk. For clients with larger accounts, he says, he's investing in private equity, venture funds, and real estate. For investors who remain skittish, Kathleen Stewart, senior wealth strategist at BNY Mellon Wealth Management in Pittsburgh, says her firm encourages clients to use dollar cost averaging to take risks at a reasonable level rather than try to time the market. One way skittish investors can gain greater confidence would be to get a better handle of their own overall financial picture. Stewart advises evaluating spending and saving habits in much the same way as one would evaluate asset allocation. Even small spending increases over time can diminish one's asset goals, she says. Relieving travel anxieties. Many seniors are eager to venture out and travel again, but remain leery about what post-pandemic travel will entail, advisors say. A few precautions can help allay fears. To entice bookings, travel companies from hotels to airlines now have good refund policies in place, says Julia Carlson, founder and chief executive of Financial Freedom Wealth Management Group in Newport, Oregon. But travelers should check to see what's offered, be it a full refund or a transfer if a trip needs to be canceled, and buy additional travel insurance to cover potential costs if a full refund or transfer is not available. Many credit cards have travel insurance policies that can cover unforeseen disruptions to your travel plans, Carlson adds, but it's important to understand what a card covers before fully relying on it. Travel cancellation, interruption, lost baggage, and emergency travel assistance are common coverages cards may offer, she says. One important coronavirus-related consideration regarding credit card coverage, some credit cards cover cancellations due to coronavirus, but only if the cardholder or a travel companion are in quarantine imposed by a physician or a government authority, says Joel Gonzalez, an analyst at WalletHub.com, a consumer finance website. If the cardholder chooses to cancel a trip for fear of the virus, they will not be covered by insurance. Rubin advises those who are making travel plans now for the next year or so to work with a reputable travel agent or company. While young travelers may be fine accepting uncertainties associated with online bookings, Rubin says senior and luxury travelers still use travel agents to manage the complexities of bucket list trips, especially for travel abroad. Advisors also recommend that skittish travelers reevaluate their travel priorities and focus on domestic road trips or visiting family. Initially, it may be best to take an independent, more intimate tour rather than, say, embark on a cruise on which there will be many people around you, Carlson says. Rubin adds, people are definitely going to go to the state parks more. We're going to see America. We're going to be thinking twice about hopping on that plane or that cruise ship. Finding your comfort zone. The post-pandemic world will also be altered in ways that may strain relationships and create anxiety, says Marty Martin, a Chicago-based financial psychologist who works with the Planning Center, a fee-only financial planning firm. There will be some awkwardness and negotiations about what's civil and what's safe. Attitudes on masks and vaccination pose perhaps the biggest challenge. Some in the younger generation may think they have to wear a mask only in the workplace to protect older workers, Martin says. Another tension point, if one person in a core group of friends decides to not get vaccinated. If you aren't comfortable engaging in certain activities with friends or colleagues because of uneven health precautions, don't succumb to pressure, but phrase your refusal gently, Martin advises. Instead of saying, no, say, I don't feel comfortable, he says. A strong relationship should withstand that, he says. Stewart of BNY Mellon Wealth Management says that reviewing your catastrophic insurance needs, such as health, long-term care, and property and casualty insurance, to make sure you have what you need in place, can also help alleviate fears and anxieties as you reemerge from the pandemic. Ultimately, says Financial Freedom's Carlson, it's important to acknowledge and express feelings of anxiety as you reemerge, and it's okay to move forward despite anxiety. You don't have to go from 0 to 100, she says. Here's this week's Up and Down Wall Street column with Randall W. Forsyth. This is what's driving stocks to records as the nation reels. This week just passed will not be remembered by stock market indexes hitting new highs or even the record toll of new COVID-19 cases, hospitalizations, and deaths. What will be recalled is another day that will live in infamy in the nation's history, when a mob, incited by the president, stormed the Capitol to try to thwart the will of the American electorate. Yet the stock market did rise through this assault on the Republic and beyond. The week ended with Dow Jones Industrial Average, the S&P 500, and the NASDAQ Composite setting records, and the Russell 2000 winding up just below its peak hit on Thursday. Even though the contrast between the continued ascent of equity prices and the hardships caused by the pandemic has been the focus of much comment here and elsewhere, the past week events point to one nearly ineluctable explanation. The stock market closing up on a day the nation witnessed the closest thing to a coup and or modern-day civil war it has ever seen will forever stand as testament to the allure of money printing, writes Danielle DiMartino Booth bracingly in her weekly Quill commentary. The Federal Reserve's Jerome Powell has already committed to effectively monetize any and all government spending. One could argue, as investors clearly did Wednesday, January 6, 2021, that multiple medium-term threats to the economy have vanished overnight, she adds. With both houses of Congress, along with the White House, in the control of the Democrats, after their candidates' dual victories in Tuesday's Senate runoff elections in Georgia, odds of additional relief spending popped higher. Indeed, President-elect Joe Biden on Friday reiterated his call for boosting the payments to most Americans to $2,000 from the $600 contained in the $900 billion stimulus bill enacted in late December. Moreover, to DiMartino Booth's point, Biden contended that the federal government should, quote, invest in deficit spending with interest rates so low, although they're on the upswing as discussed below, which of course is because the Fed's setting its federal funds target rate near zero and injecting $120 billion per month in the financial system with its securities purchases. The argument for fiscal largesse was further bolstered by the 140,000 drop in non-farm payrolls during December, reported on Friday morning, largely reflecting a 172,000 decline in employment at bars and restaurants forced to close or shorten their operating hours by the renewed surge in the coronavirus. This liquidity is reverberating once again in an intense manner through the markets for equity and risky securities, according to a report from J.P. Morgan's Global Quantitative and Derivative Strategy Team led by Nikolaos Panagiotsoglou. That's largely a result of active trading by younger investors, they add. The J.P. Morgan crews infers this from the data on New York Stock Exchange margin debt, which jumped in November, the most recent month for which numbers are available, implying a strong pickup from October and September. More timely indications of a surge in trading by small investors is a sharp upswing in option trading in lots of 10 contracts or fewer. The J.P. Morgan team cites a big rise in call option buying by retail investors in recent weeks, notwithstanding a temporary seasonal lull around the holidays. Another inference comes in the sharp rise in off-exchange trading with major over-the-counter market makers. The report adds, many online brokers that cater to younger traders with zero commissions, such as Robinhood, route their orders to these OTC market makers, which pay for order flow. Given the potential for additional fiscal support from Washington in the form of $1,400 checks, J.P. Morgan sees more of this money finding its way into the market. That won't do much to help the many small businesses that are suffering or shuttered, but the liquidity will be there to drive stock prices even higher, even if that's not the intent. Walmart is adopting socially responsible policies. ESG funds are taking notice. And ESG is environmental, social, and governance funds who are focused on finding companies that are and investing in companies that have a heightened awareness to environmental issues, social responsibility issues, and governance issues. Sarah Max. Lots of companies have gotten serious about environmental, social, and governance issues in recent years, but few are more surprising than Walmart. That's not just because of its sheer size. 2.2 million employees, 11,500 retail locations, and revenues that exceed the gross domestic product of most countries. But also because Walmart, ticker WMT, has long been anathema to socially conscious consumers and investors. Environmentalists bemoan the company's massive carbon footprint. Gun advocates criticized it for selling assault-style rifles, and workplace advocates demanded that it raise its hourly minimum wage. They've gone from being seen as a problem to becoming a significant part of the solution, says John Struer, the CEO of Calvert Research and Management, a leader in ESG research and investing. Early last year, Walmart CEO Doug McMillon began a two-year term as chairman of the Business Roundtable, the CEO trade group that recently said that corporations must act on behalf of all stakeholders, not just shareholders. In Walmart's 140-page ESG report, McMillon writes, "There are a lot of stereotypes out there about Walmart. It's no secret to us that we have critics who assume we're doing business at the expense of people and the planet, that we're all talk. The fact is, though, we've been working hard to use our scale to create positive change for a long time." The shift hasn't been lost on Wall Street. Walmart is moving faster and with more purpose and more responsibility for all its stakeholders, and really it's trying to evolve and change with the changing times, said Michael Lasser, who covers Walmart for UBS. What's more, a growing niche on Wall Street has also taken notice. Many fund managers who incorporate sustainable factors to their process have not only taken Walmart off their verboten lists, forbidden lists, but have even begun adding the company to their portfolios. In September 2019, Calvert added the company to its $3.6 billion Calvert U.S. Large Cap Core Responsible Index, ticker CSXAX. Over the past 2 years, Walmart's policies and actions, including its response to COVID-19, have been thesis-confirming, said Leah Moehlig, M-O-E-H-L-I-G, ESG senior research analyst at Calvert. To be sure, the world's largest retailer is a long way from perfect, and Walmart's ESG conversion, along with much of corporate America's, will continue to be met with skepticism. Just for starters, last month, the U.S. Department of Justice filed a lawsuit alleging that Walmart's in-store pharmacies played a role in fueling the opioid crisis. The company didn't mince words in its response. The Justice Department's investigation is tainted by historical ethics violations, and this lawsuit invents a legal theory that unlawfully forces pharmacists to come between patients and their doctors, and is riddled with factual inaccuracies and cherry-picked documents taken out of context. Walmart added that it always empowered our pharmacists to refuse to fill problematic opioids prescriptions, and they refuse to fill hundreds of thousands of such prescriptions. The retailer has been far less outspoken about its ESG progress. The company has rather quietly rolled out ambitious environmental initiatives and introduced programs to improve workplace equality and opportunity, support public health, and champion gun safety. Walmart's ESG transformation was at least partially awakened by Hurricane Katrina in 2005, when the company played an outsized role in the relief efforts. One of the most prominent features in the lobby of Walmart's global headquarters in Bentonville, Arkansas, is a painting of Walmart trucks lined up to bring supplies into New Orleans. A case study from the Harvard Kennedy School of Government points to Walmart's role in getting food, water, and other resources into flood-stricken areas. That really set the company on a different path, which just continued to evolve, says Kathleen McLaughlin, a one-time director at McKinsey & Company, who joined Walmart in 2013 as the company's first chief sustainability officer. It's really been in the past 5 or 6 years that we started to take a more holistic and expansive approach to material ESG issues. The investment case for ESG isn't just about morals, advocates argue, but it's good business. Many of Walmart's growth strategies over the past 50 years, more stores and undercutting the competition on price, have probably reached their limit, and now may even be a liability, says fund managers and analysts. If you're a retailer, you've got to be worried about reputation, because your relationship with your customer is critical, says Ingrid Dyott, co-manager of the Core Equity and Sustainable Equity Strategies at Neuberger Berman. In the digital age, the stakes are higher than ever. Bad news travels quickly, and consumers can take their business elsewhere with a click of a button. Walmart bulls say that the company's ESG work is a sign the company has improved its adaptive ways, which is critical as it transitions from a bricks-and-mortar behemoth to an e-commerce leader. While many traditional retailers have lost ground in the past year, Walmart has thrived. As retail stores were forced to close in March because of the pandemic, Walmart ramped up its same-day delivery, retooled its parking lots to make space for grocery pickup, and hired and trained staff to be personal shoppers. The company is also excelling online, thanks to a digital pivot that began with the $3 billion purchase of Jet.com in 2016. Walmart's e-commerce sales soared 79% in its November quarter. In September, the company launched Walmart Plus, a membership program meant to rival Amazon Prime. And analysts are forecasting that total Walmart sales of $555 billion when the fiscal year ends this month, up 5.9% from a year earlier. That matches the company's best growth rate since the 2009 financial crisis. Walmart sees adjusted earnings rising 13% to $5.57 a share. Last week, we began reading the series of articles that will be appearing in Barron's Magazine over this coming year, celebrating and exploring the 100 years that Barron's has been in existence. This week's offering, gold oldies but goodies, some century-old stocks still deliver. It's written by Al Root and Jacob Sonnenschein. Surviving the past 100 years hasn't been easy, particularly for public companies. While the Dow Jones Industrial Average has returned more than 10% annually over that span, many individual companies have been bought and sold, gone bust, or otherwise faded from view. For example, Sears Holding, ticker SHLDQ, which went public in 1906, filed for bankruptcy, sadly, in 2018, while General Motors, GM, launched in 1908, filed for bankruptcy Chapter 11 in 2009. While a shrunken GM has made a comeback, Sears' days as a top retailer are history. Calculating returns over a century also isn't easy. We dug through newspapers to find share prices, stock splits, and dividends, the factors that ultimately determine performance. The results should be seen as approximations, but accurate enough to tell the stories of four companies that figured significantly in America's economic history since our founding in 1921. U.S. Steel, ticker symbol X, a 20th century titan that's now a 21st century afterthought. Altria Group, M.O., the former Philip Morris, struggling with an eroding business. Railroad giant Union Pacific, UNP, which refused to give way to highways and trucks, and General Electric, GE, a reminder that the longer a company, even one co-founded by Thomas Edison, lasts, the more opportunity for it to be disrupted. Once a titan of industry, U.S. Steel has declined along with much of the rest of American manufacturing. The company was formed just after the turn of the 20th century, when steel was new and production was growing, from roughly 5 million tons in 1892 to about 40 million tons by 1921. That made U.S. Steel one of the most prominent companies of the day. It also had its critics. In 1926, our founding editor, Clarence W. Barron, complained that, quote, "The Steel Corporation has been altruistic to every interest except its common stockholder," end quote, and called for a special stock dividend. In subsequent decades, America's decline as a steelmaker took its toll. U.S. Steel peaked at about $260 a share in 1929 and didn't get back there on a split-adjusted basis until 2007. It has dropped 4.3% annually over the past 15 years. The company now isn't even the largest U.S. steel producer. That would be Nucor. It's N-U-C-O-R is the name. And the ticker symbol is N-U-E, which profited from an early shift to the electric arc furnace, which can make steel for less than the giant blast furnaces that long dominated the industry. General Electric. Founded in 1892, GE was a powerhouse by the end of 1920. America needed electricity, and General Electric helped provide it. Its strength and success are taken for granted, Barrons wrote in 1926. Over the years, GE expanded into jet engines, healthcare, and appliances. The company thrived throughout the 20th century. However, it moved into finance, a boon during the 1990s, turned into an albatross in the 21st century. General Electric was also hit hard by its 2015 purchase of the power and grid business of Alstom, that's A-L-S-T-O-M, ticker A-O-A-L-O, and it's a French company, a bet on power generated by coal, a high-polluting fuel now out of favor in much of the world. GE stock has dropped 15% annually for the past 5 years. Nonetheless, power generation from sources other than coal remains a big business, and that means there may still be a place for GE in 2021. Union Pacific. The railroad industry is a shadow of its former self when it used to carry millions of passengers a year. That hasn't stopped Union Pacific stock from keeping up with the Dow during the past 100 years. At the dawn of the 20th century, there were roughly 200,000 miles of railroad track in the U.S., and in 1923, Barron's praised Union Pacific's greatly increased efficiency on the system. Today, travel is more easily accomplished by plane or car, while trucking has become the go-to way to ship goods from state to state. Highways didn't disrupt railroads, however. It made them the low-cost shippers. Railroads also got a big boost in 1980 when the industry was deregulated. Union Pacific shares have generated around 12% annualized over the past 40 years, roughly even with the Dow's return. Apparently, it isn't easy to start a railroad. Altria, annual return 15%. That's historically. Altria began life in 1847 as Philip Morris, and it really hit its stride in 1924 when it created the Marlboro cigarette brand. Originally marketed to women, Marlboros had an ivory, quote, ivory tip designed to keep lipstick from smearing. In March of 1930, Barron's reported that heavy advertising expenses for the new product had, quote, cut into earnings, but the brand became a huge success. By 1985, the cigarette makers were targets of a consumer backlash for having sold products they knew caused cancer. Philip Morris split in two in 2008, with Altria keeping the iconic MO ticker, serving the U.S., and Philip Morris International, PM is the ticker symbol, focused on the rest of the world. Both are now looking to smokeless cigarettes for growth. Altria stock has lost 1.1% annualized over the past 5 years, while Philip Morris has risen 3.6%. The Dow has returned about 15% annualized in the same period. Kenneth Pringle contributed to this article. Here's an economic opinion from Matthew C. Klein. Why the post-pandemic future could be bright. Productivity gains could be here to stay. The coronavirus has displaced tens of millions of workers and forced thousands of businesses to close. But the virus has also encouraged rapid changes in the way we work and consume, and some of those changes could be both beneficial and long-lasting. Once the virus is eradicated, higher productivity in retail, the reduction of long commutes by people working from home, and the conversion of offices and hotels to apartments could eventually make Americans better off than we were before. Some of the benefits could take years to materialize, but others are already here. In fact, productivity has already grown at an 8% yearly rate since the pandemic began, the fastest pace of improvement since the 1960s. Output per hour worked tends to rise sharply during downturns as companies slash costs and the least efficient businesses are forced to close. Productivity grew more than 4% a year in 2002 and 2003 and by 6% in 2009, but just 2% each year from 2004 to 2007 and only by 1% each year from 2010 to 2019. Some of this is due to the way data are measured. The average worker's wage mechanically rises when a lot of low-paid workers suddenly stop having jobs. For example, temporarily inflating aggregate labor productivity, even if there hasn't been any genuine efficiency gains. But there are reasons to think that there are other, more positive forces at work this time around, and that the recent uptick could be durable, even after society returns to normal. After all, productivity has kept rising even as many low-paid workers were rehired in sectors such as hospitality and retail. Spencer Hill, an economist at Goldman Sachs, thinks that labor, quote, labor reallocation accounts for less than half, end quote, of the reported gains in productivity so far, which argues against a rapid reversal of aggregate productivity next year as the virus is eradicated. Start by looking at how the virus has changed how Americans consume. It's safer to buy goods online and have them delivered or dropped off in the trunk of your car than it is to go into a physical store. The desire for safety may pass once the virus is gone, but selling goods online is more efficient for many retailers, requiring fewer people and less expensive real estate to generate the same amount of turnover. Since the pandemic began, the total real value of goods consumed has grown more than 7%, while the number of people working in the goods distribution sector, retail, wholesale, truck transportation, warehousing, and delivery services has dropped about 2.5%. Put another way, the amount of stuff Americans have been able to buy from a given number of retail and logistics workers has jumped 10% in less than a year. That represents a dramatic acceleration of the long-running trend of Americans consuming more goods while employing fewer people in the distribution of those goods. Hill estimates that the change in retail alone could boost America's overall productivity rate by about 0.5% each year, at least through 2022. For perspective, labor productivity rose just 1.4% each year on average from 2017 to 2019. Then there is the rise in remote work necessitated by the pandemic. That's not obviously a productivity booster for anyone with children, at a time when schools are closed, but for many others, the absence of a commute saves an enormous amount of time and stress each day. Those gains would be widely shared once the virus is eradicated. Before the pandemic, about 40% of Americans who didn't work from home spent at least an hour commuting each day, with 10% spending at least 2 hours commuting back and forth. The share of Americans who work from home full-time was just 5.7% in 2019, although almost a quarter of American workers were working from homes a few hours each day. As of December, almost 26% of full-time workers, that's a big number, were doing their jobs from home to avoid the virus. Almost 60% of the workers in business and financial operations occupations, computer and mathematical occupations, architecture and engineering occupations, and legal occupations were working remotely. About 33 million Americans were working from home at the end of last year. If remote work becomes normal, some of those long-distance commuters may choose to stay home permanently or relocate to a different part of the country where they wouldn't need to travel so far to access urban amenities. That in turn could encourage some of the blue-collar service workers they indirectly employ to migrate to suburbs and cheaper cities, potentially lifting their real wages. The shift could free up valuable real estate currently used as office space. While it would initially be costly to convert buildings to needed housing, the longer-term gains could be substantial. Cost-conscious suburbanites might even choose to relocate to urban cores as apartment prices fall relative to wages and interest rates. Similarly, a permanent drop in business travel could free up buildings currently used as hotels for other uses. These positive trends are occurring at a time when the private sector's financial position is strong. The majority of Americans are richer than they were before the pandemic thanks to the rise in home values and stock prices, while businesses are flush with cash and earning record profits. Spending power is set to get a further boost thanks to the recently passed relief bill and the additional checks that will likely be distributed in the next few months. which should help lower the risk of permanent damage to workers and businesses. Put it together, and the prospects for pandemic survivors could be better than what might have been reasonably expected at the end of 2019. Here's a contrarian opinion from Ben Levisone. The stock market had a fantastic week. Now it needs to drop. The market has gotten so optimistic that it could make even Little Orphan Annie seem like a pessimist. Emotionally, it was a bruising week. Rioters stormed the Capitol building and disrupted the certification of the U.S. presidential results. The Democrats won two Senate seats up for grabs in Georgia. Friday's payroll reports showed the U.S. shed 140,000 jobs in December, the first decline since April, a depressing sign for anyone whose gaze extends beyond Wall Street. All three could have, should have, caused the stock market to drop. Rationally, the bad news can all be explained away. The assault on the Capitol, it sounds like a John Carpenter movie, might have raised questions about the state of U.S. democracy, but it did nothing to impact economic forecasts or earnings expectations. Democratic control of Congress is so narrow that legislatures' hands might be tied when it comes to making market-friendly changes. And December's job losses were caused by massive drops in hospitality and leisure, almost entirely because of renewed COVID-19 lockdowns. When the coronavirus starts to go away, those jobs should return. The market certainly was sanguine. The S&P 500 rose 1.8% to 3,824.68, while the Dow Jones Industrial Average advanced 491.49 points, or 1.6% to 31,097.97, and the NASDAQ Composite gained 2.4% to 13,201.98. All three closed Friday at record highs. The small cap Russell 2000 up 5.9% to 2009.61, left them all in the dust by notching its best start to a year since 1987. Of course, the market's continued rise makes little sense, except under the most optimistic projections. They start with the vaccines, which should allow people to get out of their homes and back to the office at some point in 2021. And if that happens, economic growth should surge and earnings should rebound, making an expensive market. The S&P 500 now trades at 22.8 times 12-month forward earnings, look far more reasonably priced. But what if the getting back to work signals a top for the market? It's not that far-fetched. Retail trading has spiked during lockdown because people have the two things they need to actively engage with the market: time and money. It does make you wonder how long before we queue up. It's a hard knock life. That's all for this week. If you know someone who could use our service, or you're interested in volunteering or donating to our organization, we are a nonprofit. To keep us on the air reading to the vision and print impaired, please call 508-539-2030 or visit our website, audiblelocalledger.org. As always, thank you for listening and your continued support. This is your reader, George Crying, saying please be well, be safe. Bye for now.